You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. Today I'm speaking with Paul Curry, who, if you're not familiar with his work, in the write-up for this episode, I've described him as a sweaty, bearded turbo clown. I think that's fair. I don't think Paul would be adverse to being described like that. I saw his show, as you'll hear, I think I referred to it in this interview. I saw Paul's show on the last night of Edinburgh this year with a couple of street clown friends of mine, and we were all absolutely gobsmacked at how original it was, and particularly original with whilst using some of the things that we're familiar with from clowning to find new ways of using familiar things. It was really original. It was incredibly heartfelt and evocative, and the audience were just going nuts. So if you haven't seen his stuff, ordinarily I'd tell you to revise people. I don't know that it's possible to have a bit of revision on Paul without seeing his stuff live. I'm sure that any kind of bootleg gig videos you might find won't do it justice, but you might noodle around. Paul's website is mrpaulcurry.com. Maybe he's got some video stuff up there. So without further ado, I really enjoyed talking to Paul Curry. I remember meeting you at Glastonbury a few years ago.
Yeah.
When you'd just come off from doing a street show.
Yeah.
And I was about to go on and do one. And it may even have been the last street show I ever did, because I quit
really?
The street years ago.
So you don't do it anymore?
No, I don't do it anymore.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I used to, even when I'd retired, I would come back and do Glastonbury every year, because I just would do it to get in. And
I remember watching you specifically though that time, because somebody just before you went on, one of the tech team at the outside stage that we were performing at, said that you did stand up.
Yeah.
So I specifically stayed and went, oh, okay. Something kind of went off in my head and went, all right, let's okay. See. So he does stand up and does street theater as well. And I thought you were great. Actually, I watched your show.
Thank you very much.
I love the street show.
Thanks, man. I enjoyed it. Particularly at Glastonbury. I think when I was doing street shows at Glastonbury, I couldn't remember half my show. I'd taken all of the skills out of it. I would spend 40 minutes getting changed whilst talking to them.
But that's
and
the
then
best
on
street
the rope at the end.
Yeah,
I agree.
That's the best street theater, though.
Well, let's talk about this before we get proper stuck into you and where you are now. I'm really excited to have someone, because I remembered meeting you and going, "Holy shit, there's another one."
Yeah.
It's like you.
That's kind of what I thought.
You meet Pete Dobbing and Asher. That's
it.
Yeah.
Well, that's how I felt whenever I first saw Dr. Brown.
Yeah.
Holy shit, there's another one.
Yeah.
I thought I was the only one doing what he was doing. And then whenever I saw Sam Simmons as well too, I was like, oh my God.
Yes.
There's another one.
Who else is in that gang? Spencer?
Spencer's in that gang. I would even, boy with a tape in his face as well. Because the first time I ever did the Stand Comedy Club in 2009, this might sound pretentious, but everybody lost their shit in the comedy club that night, because they'd never seen anything like what I'd done, which is pretty much, I was just doing clowning. I was just coming in and bringing a bit of clowning, a bit of Andy Kaufman, a little bit of Vic Reeves, kind of mishmash of and Steve Martin and peppering it. And that's what I do. And I did it on stage in the Stand Comedy Club. They lost their shit. All the local comedians, sorry. The audience were baffled as they should be. When I say they lost their shit, I meant the comedians
that's
lost
a crucial
their shit.
Detail.
Yeah. The other comedians lost their shit. They were like, It was great. And the Stand immediately were, and that was at the Red Raw.
Yep.
So it was just me doing Red Raw. So the Stand immediately got in contact with me, invited me straight back, which was great.
Red Raw is the new act.
Yeah, it was the new act night. And I made no money. I paid for my flights to go over to do that. And so I was making a loss that night anyway, as you do with comedy all the time. But then the thing is, a week later, I got a call from one of these comedians that I became really close friends with and I have known ever since, contacted me and said, holy shit, another comedian turned up tonight and he's like doing similar stuff to what you're doing, but he's got like tape on his face. And this was whenever he was just starting.
Yeah.
He was just, Sam.
Sam Wills.
Sam Wills. And, Sam had just started out. So this was Sam's first little dip in his toe into comedy clubs around the circuit. He was basically doing a circuit. I later on then found out that Sam had this like 5-year plan that he like very much completed and then went even further beyond that, as we all know. But that was his first foray into stand-up comedy clubs. And I was like, shit. Oh my God. And I thought, this is great, but also, who the freaking hell is this guy?
Yeah.
Then I found out from other street performer friends who he was. But at the time, whenever I first started, I was doing very silent kind of similar stuff. But I was obviously doing a bit of talking in between. But yeah, it was amazing actually for me to know that there seemed to be this new wave of clowning coming into comedy clubs, like Dr. Brown, like Sam Simmons, like, you know, there was this new wave of, I guess, alternative absurdism, if you want to give it something of a title. Yeah, so that excited me.
Do you have any theories as to where it comes from or why it's happening now?
It's loads. Because stand-up comedy is clowning, it's a very base form of clowning. It's clowning stripped back. I mean, I did my research over the years and found out that some of the first clowning, or the first stand-up, came from the traveling circuses, Barnum and Bailey's, with a guy called Dan Rice.
Okay.
Don't know if you've ever heard of him.
I haven't heard any about this.
Okay, so Dan, so you know the image of Uncle Sam?
Mm-hmm.
That's based on the clown Dan Rice.
Okay.
He wore the American flag as a suit, which was extremely controversial at the time. A satirist, a famous satirist, but he was a clown, first and foremost, in the circus, in the traveling circuses, in the Dust Bowl era of America. But then he was the first clown to actually start talking to the audience and addressing an entire audience. And that is the theory of where modern stand-up came from, was okay. Dan Rice is almost like the germ. He's the seed that sort of that spawned
Patient
that.
Zero.
Obviously. Yeah. Obviously, you know, comedy's been around for hundreds and hundreds and thousands of years, blah blah blah. But the concept of one person addressing an entire a huge audience, an auditorium, so to speak, for, you know, 30 to 40 to 50 an hour, kind of came from that.
Okay.
Supposedly. I mean, okay. I've read books on it and stuff like that. And that, you know, because it just fascinates me where it came from, the concept, this concept of one person standing on a stage, talking.
Is it happening? I mean, I think of the people we've named thus far, they're all the people that are kind of the weird, I don't even know what to call, do you want to call that group clowns or
no, because it's still no, because it's still stand up, you know. it's you know, you're still, it's absurdist, I guess, absurdist. It's still comedy, it still comes under the guise of comedy. I mean, the way I like to describe it is, the way I like to explain it is that comedy is still young. It's still very, very young, and it's got many, many genres, just like music. But music, people know what kind of music they like. So I like to give this example a lot whenever I'm doing stand-up, especially if I spot someone in the crowd who is not getting my stuff, but everybody else is that they're like a Kenny Rogers fan at a Napalm Death gig.
Mm-hmm.
They basically said yes to go and see some music. Someone said, hey, do you want to go and see some music? They went, yeah, cool, music. I love music.
Yeah.
They've just went into the gig and they haven't asked what kind of music it is, and they're just standing there. Yeah, they're watching people on stage playing instruments, playing the guitar, but just not the way they like to hear it played. It's up too loud, it's distorted, whatever, but it's still an instrument. And it's the same with comedy for me. They should ask what kind of comedy they're going to see. People just plow in and they have this, you know, there's this sort of universal idea of, oh, if it's funny, it's funny. If it is funny, it is going to be funny. That's just not true. It's simply not true, because everybody's got different tastes.
Yes.
Just the way you have with music.
it occurs to me there may be people listening to this who have not seen you, and we have yet to kind of totally flesh out the sort of thing it is that you do.
Yeah.
So how about, rather than, I hate saying to people, so what sort of thing do you do? I'll tell you what I remember from your show that I saw this year.
Yeah.
I saw Release the Baboons.
Yes.
I think I saw re-release the Baboons.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
I saw your show this year, which you pronounce like this.
Milk.
Good. I've been pronouncing it right. I'm glad to see that.
It's all right.
And I saw it with a bunch of street clowns on the last night.
Right, okay.
Edinburgh, and it was the perfect way to end the festival.
Oh, thank you.
They agreed as well.
Oh, it was fun.
So I saw it a kind of like sweaty, shouty, turbo clowning, kind of getting people involved and dirty.
Yeah.
And the standout bits, I remember most immediately. The image for me was the tiny Action Man version of yourself on a pole flown over the heads of the audience while people shot party poppers
into
the conclusion of the show, which was just 100 times more magical than that description even can do it justice.
Yeah.
You got people on stage buttering an ironing board.
Yeah.
I remember there was a thing about a brick. And the cornflakes bit, you're eating a bowl of cornflakes whilst having your heart broken, and they're all falling out of your mouth and you're re-eating them.
Yeah.
So we can talk about some of those bits and where they came from and where they're
going.
I'd be fascinated to do that. But I just kind of wanted to flag that up in terms of people listening to this episode. That's the territory.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's play. It's just play. It's really all it is. A lot of the stuff that I do on stage that you saw on that show, I would do with kids. I do it with families on the street, little kids, stuff like that. Some of it, obviously not. Some of the more kind of, you know, profane stuff and more sexualized stuff, obviously not. But the rest of it, the majority of the show, I do on the street. Like the eating the cornflakes, having a breakdown. It's basically a man having a breakdown at breakfast is the concept of that. And I've done it on the streets, and it's just me sitting silently, gently beginning to eat a bowl of cornflakes to the theme tune of Arthur, Christopher Cross singing, what is it, When You Get Caught Between the Moon and New York City. But it's such a sad song. And then eventually I just become more and more emotional. But I've done that in front of kids who absolutely lose their shit over it. They love it because it's just an adult spitting cornflakes everywhere. And then behind them, you've got the parents who are looking at me, some of them horrified that this is happening. But most of them come up. I've had parents coming up to me afterwards and saying, I know exactly where you were in your head because of their kids, because they have kids and because they go to those moments of just like despair.
Kind of,
they could relate to the despair. They could also relate to the, you know, the madness of it as well,
and
too.
And the keeping going. As a parent, I relate to that kind of, I can't go on, I must go on quality to it.
Yeah.
Like, I've just got to keep going.
Yeah, just
got to
keep going. Just got to keep going.
Eating the same cornflakes.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's lovely that it sort of, people take different things from it, you know? So it's nice that even that piece, you know? But I love doing that on the street.
So, can you tell us then, Did you start as a puppeteer? Were you doing street shows before you were doing puppetry? What was the instinct?
Well, I did theatre years and years ago. I studied theatre for 3 years. Well, performing arts, sorry. It wasn't theatre. I did performing arts for
three. Was that in Northern Ireland?
It was in Northern Ireland, Belfast, yeah. And that was whenever I first... So that was with college, and I was only about 17. So I did... I went straight from school to do performing arts for 3 years.
And what ideas did you have about what that course was going to be? What excited you?
Absolutely, the fact that I didn't have to go and get a job, and that I could play. I play music. I play in bands. I've been in a lot of bands, and still am. I still play guitar and sing and write songs and stuff in bands. So the audition to get into this course was that. You had to perform a monologue or sing a song, and I just thought, yeah, cool, I've got a few songs kicking around, and I got onto the course, and then it had music, it had acting, it had stage production, stage design. It was one of these performing arts courses. You basically got to dip your finger into all sorts of parts of the performing world, I guess, and that was whenever I first tried. I remember I tried a little bit of stand-up. All of about 5 minutes, I got on stage and sort of tried stuff during lunchtime on the stage in the canteen of the college, and it was horrible.
Was that a gig that you put on?
No. I literally this. We were just fanning around because we were just hyperactive kind of teenage.
So what, you just stood on a table and said, everyone pay attention?
Yeah, yeah. It's for, like, everybody was doing a little turn. There was some dancers doing a bit, and then I got up to try and do a bit of stand-up. So I remember that was my first foray into, like, standing with a microphone on a stage.
Making stuff up?
Yeah, just sort of improvising. I think I did maybe, like, vaguely try to do a goon sketch or something.
Okay. Who was your idea of stand-up comedy at that point?
Well, whenever I used to hang out with my friends in my teens, I would, it was always Python. We would always regurgitate Python sketches and stuff like that. And whenever I grew up, when I was really small, though, I used to love the anarchy of Cannon and Ball. Friggin' loved Bobby Ball. Loved Bobby Ball's aggression.
That's a first appearance on the podcast for Cannon and Ball.
There you go. Hey.
I've met them. They knocked me out of a competition. They did. Bobby, one of the best bits of that awful process was Bobby Ball going, I like you. I like you. He told me he liked me about 40 times. Nice guy. So
I always remember pissing myself with my dad watching them. And
I don't remember their act. What kind of thing did they do?
It was just that they were a double act. They were this, you know, they were the knockoff kind of versions of, like, that came around in the '80s. Whenever I was younger, in the early '80s, like, I was born in 1974, so I kind of grew up with that. Yeah, so early '80s. So you had the knockoff. Because Eric Morgan and Ernie Wise were obviously getting a certain age, then obviously TV producers. Looking back now, I realize TV producers were like, well, we need the next friggin' Morgan and Wise. Yeah, who we got? And they had, we had Little and Large and Cannon and Ball then Hale and Pace and all these, like, kind of knockoff versions where they were desperately trying to find the next Morgan and Wise to fill that gap because they knew they were coming to an end. But Bobby Ball particularly appealed to me. The anarchy of his aggression to Tommy Cannon, him grabbing him, the two of them grabbing each other, and him just being frustrated all the time. And then also Michael Barrymore, who used to go on.
This is a safe space, and you can talk about Michael Barrymore.
I know, it's a safe space. I'm talking early Barrymore. If you ever see him on the Royal Variety shows and stuff like that, the energy of the guy was unreal. I mean, he was like, and I guess that's what he was going for, but he was like John Cleese on acid. Yeah, so that sort of level of comedy. And then, of course, the young ones and stuff like that as well, too.
Yeah.
Later on, whenever I got a bit older, and then I got into the young ones. So I guess, like, harken back to what you were saying, like, whenever watching my show, that it was very sweaty and shouty and stuff like that. I mean, I've always been drawn to that, like, the young ones, the aggression that's within them.
Did you watch The Dangerous Brothers?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I think that was part of my route into street performing, was me and my mate Noel regurgitating Dangerous Brothers
sketches.
Rick Mayle and Adrian Edmondson as Lord Richard
Dangerous.
I did
that a little bit with a friend of mine as well, too, from London, who actually looked very like Ed Edmondson, the two of us, and I kind of wanted to be Rick Mayle. But we did similar stuff as well, too. We kind of wanted to do that Dangerous Brothers thing vibe. Yeah.
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 And so what?
And that's actually how I kind of got in the street performing as well, weirdly enough. Yeah. It was another guy, Steve Bamford, who still lives in Belfast. But we did little bits of. Actually, it was Punch and Judy. The two of us used to do a Punch and Judy show together, but we would do it, Punch and Judy, via the Dangerous Brothers, like it would be like if they were doing it. So we would dress up and come out the front of the booth, and we had all the puppets, and we had the puppet booth that we got a land off a friend of ours. But we thought, we're gonna kind of bring punk to Punch and Judy, you know, punk and Judy. Sorry, that's terrible. But that's
not something I would have anticipated, and it completely makes sense.
Punch and Judy. Yeah,
tell me about what attracted you to that energy and that anger, those kind of, like, the Bobby Ball thing. There is certain, you know, there's kind of violence. It's slapstick violence, but I think what the Dangerous Brothers used to do was it had an edge.
Yeah.
It was slapstick violence where you could probably actually get hurt quite often.
Yeah. Yeah.
And was there something that you were kind of going towards in that, or was there something you were going away from? I'll tell you an example of what I mean. For me, it was the anarchy, because I went to a very regimented school and I hated it. And so probably what really appealed was grown-ups going, you don't have to be like that.
Totally.
Swear and shout and all the rest of
absolutely.
It.
Of course, that's that. But that is the appeal in it, isn't it, really? You know, as a teenager, and then you're watching these older, especially Python, for God's sake. I mean, they all look like teachers anyway. They all look like sort of boring geography teachers who then
that's a really good point.
They all look so friggin' boring. But that was the appeal, because they were so crazy, mental. And then, of course, they were very posh as well. But they were mental. And especially Cleese. Cleese was my favorite. Cleese, and this is maybe where the germ of a lot of my comedy comes from, is that moment where Cleese loses his shit so well. He goes from complete calm to absolutely losing his shit. And obviously that comes across in Fawlty Towers so often. And that, I loved that. I loved that, that extreme dip in personality within one person, you know, that being super calm and then just losing his shit, banging his head against walls, and then suddenly complete calm. He's fine. And that always appealed to me. And then that, yeah, that sort of the non sequitur of that, you're kind of like, what the hell's going on inside that person's head? What is going on in there? And I kind of wanted to be able to put that across, because you knew it was an act, but like, how do I get to that level of madness? How do I get that level of madness to look that crazy, as to be as crazy as that person?
So this is Paul. I think you can, you know, whether you can see him or not, or whether you've seen the picture accompanying this episode or not, that sounds like the voice of a sweaty bearded turbo clown, surely. There's lots more coming from Paul shortly. He's someone, again, I find this with clowns. I mentioned Seymour Mace later in the show. I think people who have got experience of clowning are that much more liable to open up. There we go. That's a non-scientific sweeping generalisation. And I feel that we get quite early, whenever I talk to people who are used to kind of living in, and as clowns would have it, living in the shit. Like, do you know what I mean? Living and performing in a place of failure, of acceptance, of accepting one's own failure, that sort of thing. You know, quite deliberately, and I think, as I say in this episode, it's that is a skill I find very, very difficult to do. I've got too much in the way of me accepting and admitting my own failures to an audience. But I think those performers are that much more inclined to come right out and talk about their mental health issues. I mean, we also know a good deal of stand-ups who do that too. Maybe my theory is bunk. But I really appreciate Paul being very honest and candid, as he was, about his struggles with mental health. And I would remind all of you that, I don't know. I feel like I should do some sort of midway message here, or maybe give you a number to phone. It's not going to be my phone number. But if you're listening to this, if you're struggling with any mental health issues yourself, I remember there was a Samaritan's poster years ago, I always think of, on the tube in London, which was a very kind of Yellow Submarine, Beatles-esque swirl of colours and stuff. And that kind of 70s aesthetic. And it said, if for any reason your life doesn't feel exactly like this, call us. And I always remember thinking that was a beautiful way of putting it, because I think when I'm happy, I remember just how happy I am and just how wonderful everything is. And then whenever I've struggled, I have felt like that was reality. And that's one of the hardest things. I always think the Red Dwarf episode, Better Than Life, was secretly about depression. You remember that? The computer game that you didn't know you were playing? Whether it was about that or not. I think there is, when people struggle with mental health, I think the temptation is to think that that is what the world is really like. That negative view of the world is, well, that's, I can see this clearly. And actually, it's not. It's not. So if that's you, if you're someone, this is very BBC, if you're affected by the issues raised in this show, then talk to someone, talk to a professional, talk to a friend, Google yourself up some online cognitive behavioural therapy. You can do that. There's a couple of places somewhere in Australia, I think, that you can access that easily online. And don't keep it to yourself, and don't think that that is the way the world is. More on that, perhaps, in the waffle that follows this episode. But it's not all doom and gloom. Of course, I'm really appreciative for Paul for coming along. And thank you to Pete Dobbing and Daryl J. Carrington at Loco Comedy in Bristol for helping to arrange this one when Paul was performing at their excellent club. And by all accounts, it was a typically storming performance. So do check out MrPaulCurry.com. And I've had some lovely emails. You can email me info@comedianscomedian.com. Facebook.com. People have been suggesting guests on the Facebook page. People have suggested so many guests on individual posts on the Facebook page, it's become almost unreadable. So what we'll do from now on is I will pin a post to the top of that page that says, feel free to suggest names under this one post, and there's a little bit more manageable. But thank you, everyone that has. Some excellent suggestions there. I got an email from a listener called Joe, and he talks about Edinburgh and doing his own show in Edinburgh. And he says, speaking of Edinburgh moments, your show, wow. As a total Goldsmith noob, and he spells that in the correct way, N00B. Well done, Joe. I never saw any of the four previous shows. Is there any way of experiencing the first three in visual, audio, or script form? That's an interesting idea. I mean, really, the best bits of those of the first two shows are on Princess Uncle Stew, which you can download free from comedianscomedian.com /album and indeed /shop. Two separate things you can get there. And the third one, I got a copy of, but there's some bits I'm not very happy about it in a couple of ways. Anyway, back to Joe. He said, I'd only seen an hour, which felt like your ceremony stamping yourself as a comedy craftsperson. Well, that's very kind of you, Joe. But compared to what that felt like you saying, this is what Stuart Goldsmith comedy is about. A Stuart Goldsmith hour, he goes on, is an overwhelmingly positive, geeky extravaganza. I'm definitely going to catch it on tour. Well, Joe, thanks, man, and I'm very glad you brought up the tour. It is now on sale. If you want to come and see what at least one listener describes as an overwhelmingly positive, geeky extravaganza, which is nice, man. I've never really been niche, but it's nice to think that people might consider me geeky. As I've mentioned before, I was always what Richard Sandling said he would have called at school. He said he'd have called me, what was it? A double agent, because I could hang out with the cool kids. I got on with the geeks, but I didn't have to hang out with the geeks, so I could never really truly be one of them. Thanks, Rich. I think of that often. But nonetheless, if you're interested in coming to see the tour show, which has geeky bits and completely acceptable to a non-geek audience bits, you can find out all of that information at comedianscomedian.com/tour. And if you get that, anything written there in green that says, hey Stu, fix this, is a message to me, because it's not. I'm advertising this now, and this episode will go live on Monday, by which time there will be no green ink left on that page, I inverted commas promise. It's such a fun show to do. You know what it's like trying to advertise your own work. You know, you've heard the guests on this show who are very happy to go, I'm amazing. I'm not one of those guys. I'm one of the 99% of us who go, oh yeah, you should probably check it out. You'd like it. But I can tell you how much I enjoyed doing it, which should be as much of a mark of quality as anything else. Bloody hell, I love doing this show. It's called Compared to What. It's not entirely about the baby. There's other jokes as well. And it's just loads of fun. And what I'm hoping, very much hoping to do, is to repeat the structure that we did last year of, I can't guarantee this for every single venue, but I think this is happening definitely by far the majority, is that I will do the whole show Compared to What in an hour, and then there'll be a break, and then people who feel like that's them, that'll do, they can leave, and anyone that wants to come back can see me do another 40 minutes or so of new stuff from notes, none of which exists yet. And also we'll have a bit of a Q&A, we'll have a chat about the podcast. People came prepped with some really good questions last time, so let's do that again, and you can make an evening of it. So comedianscomedian.com/tour. I'm not even going to read out the places, you can find them on the website, and as soon as I've got them properly, every single one locked in, there's a couple of others to be added, then I will tell you about them on a future episode. So thank you, Joe, thanks for your email, thanks for bringing that up, and thanks for donating. Thank you to everyone that's donated. I've got a few more recurring payments coming recently, and they are always good to see. If you'd like to go to comedianscomedian.com/donate, then you can support the show with a recurring monthly payment of £1, £2, £5, or even £10 if you're an absolute legend. I nearly said Hammer Legend there because I've got that in my head. I can't be stealing other shows' catchphrases. I think you can be a legend, a myth, or a super Beowulf, something like that. They're worth checking out anyway. Or you can pay me a one-off thing of whatever you'd pay for a bottle of wine, or you can, if you're a kind of an ultra Goldsmith, you can pay me a pound a show. I think I'm going to organise some sort of little pin badge. Should I do this? Like a little prefect badge that says ultra, ultra Goldsmith on it, or something similar, something better than that. Who knows? So thank you. Thank you, everybody. Apologies for the slightly rambling nature of this middle section. I will explain why I'm rambling when we get to the waffle after the show. Thank you for listening. Please enjoy the second half of my conversation with Mr. Paul Curry.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
What is attractive to you about inhabiting that madness, or letting that madness inhabit you?
Okay, it's therapy, I guess. It's a form of therapy, I suppose, you know, because it's like, I get like primal scream therapy. You get it out of your system and you feel so much. I mean, I feel so much calmer after one of my shows, as you can imagine. Yeah, I would just go and sit in a coffee shop so quietly on my own and just chill out. I can't do what a lot of other comedians do, which is just go out on the tear and go on the piss. Like this year, I spent the entire Edinburgh Fringe sober for the first time, actually, and didn't touch a drop. I would do my show, and you've seen it. It's high level, sweaty madness, and then I would just go and sit on my own and not talk to anyone for about 2 hours in a coffee shop and just read or write in my diary or whatever. So I'm actually quite a calm person anyway, but yeah, I guess we've got all those sides to us anyway, you know, everybody's got many different sides, personalities, but I don't know, I just always enjoyed that high level of energy, like a Robin Williams as well too. I would watch when I was younger, Mork and Mindy, all that kind of madness, you know. But yeah, but I also suffer depression as well too. I suffer from depression, and I only found this out a couple of years ago. Well, this is taking a dip.
Not at all.
I've been in therapy for the last previous like couple of years doing CBT.
Yeah, very familiar with that. Cognitive behavioral therapy. Yeah,
and
find that.
Great, really. I mean, great. It's all good. I mean, I recommend everybody should do therapy and talk about stuff as more often, I think. This world would be a better place if people communicated a bit more and were a bit more honest with each other.
I've often thought we should be, among the things they should teach in school, along with how to bleed a radiator. And, do you know what I mean?
How to bleed your mind.
Yeah, they should
teach people. How to let the pressure out of your head.
They should teach people to let the pressure out of their heads.
No one has a school-based conversation of just like, this is what happiness is.
And
if you're... Because it's interesting what you said to me about, I discovered I had depression. Because I think before you come to that realization of going, oh, not everyone feels like this. You just think, oh, this is my view of the world.
Yeah.
Shit.
Yeah,
I totally. Don't deserve XYZ. Totally. You know, all those kind of.
And mood swings as well. I used to suffer really bad at mood swings, like big time. You know, I would go into a rage with someone or whatever. I would get really pissed off. And then all of a sudden, you know, I used to burn so many bridges with people with this, like, sort of anger. And then I guess I channeled it into the comedy a little bit, I guess. So, I mean, maybe it came across that way. But I never knew it was depression. And then, I went to therapy there a couple of years ago. So it was.
But is that ongoing or is that something that you...
For
the time being?
No, I mean, I've started it again, to be honest. Just because I was having some relationship issues there recently, so I kind of had a bit of a wobble, so I'm going back into therapy again just to chat about it a bit more. But it is good to talk to someone who like a, you know, a counselor who doesn't know you, doesn't know any of your friends, doesn't know, you know, just, and you can just offload.
Yeah.
So much stuff.
I think the relationship with anger is really interesting to me because that's something I've only started to, I'm not a very angry person. I don't have a lot of issues with anger. Although, having said that, I've heard one of the sort of CBT or similar kind of therapy types of theories is that depression is anger turned inwards.
Yeah.
And then I've certainly seen
it's self-hatred, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of like you're angry at something, but you don't want to hurt the people around you, so you turn the anger inwards, and then you end up being angry at yourself and hating yourself and those kind of things.
Yeah, well, what I learned was that it feeds off, depression feeds off self-destruct. So it feeds off negativity, so then you start looking for negativity to feed the depression. So then you start doing negative stuff. You start, like, I mean, for me, it was just, I was, you know... it's turned into a massive therapy session for me. But yeah,
it often just does. You're very, I mean, you know.
Have we gone into the therapy session too quick? This is very.
Slightly early than usual.
Oh, maybe it's because I've only had 2 hours sleep. You see, that's why
I don't want to take advantage of that.
Okay, right.
I don't want you to say anything
in a vulnerable position. No.
But equally, this is the nature of
no,
of
I
this
don't.
Conversation.
I have no regrets. I would. Nothing. No. No, man. No, it's all good. But I'm a lot calmer, weirdly enough, getting back onto the conversation of comedy, but Kit Copstick came to see the show this year, and one of the most interesting things she said to me afterwards, and I mean, I know that you've seen it, and you said it was just, I don't know if, she noticed a difference in my performance style this year in the show, where she was like, I don't know what's happened to you, but like, have you been doing a lot of like, have you been taking a lot of medication, or have you just come off? No, that was it. She said, have you come off some heavy drugs or something? Because your whole persona on stage is calmer. It's much calmer, even though it's still crazy manic. Mm. You just have a certain calmness to you, which is weird that she picked up on that. And a few other people did as well, mentioned this. And I didn't say anything to them about the CBT, that I've been in therapy. But there you go. It obviously, it did come across.
And that enables you that observation is that there is more light and shade between them.
Oh, absolutely.
The
yeah, absolutely.
I put that down to kind of you maturing more as a performer.
Yeah.
I kind of was like, difficult to claim retrospectively. I saw that too, but I hadn't kind of made any psychological observations. Like I've only seen one of your shows before.
Yeah,
but I just felt that it was kind of a more considered, like, and now I'm going to hold on to it, and now I'm going to let it go.
Yeah, yeah. And I did do that purposely, like even the bit with the teddy bear and stuff like that, where I openly did honestly tell the audience why I did this piece with a teddy bear, where I just Teddy Bear's Picnic music plays over the top of it, and I just hold a teddy bear looking at it and then start pulling sort of strained, upset faces. You know, I start getting emotional. Not cry. I don't cry, but I just get very emotional and frown and start sort of getting worried. And obviously that's up to interpretation. So then I come back to it and mention and ask the audience, do they want to know what the teddy bear bit was about? Because everybody thinks, oh God, has he gone like some weird pedo thing? What the fucking hell? Where did he go with this in his head? And I want them to feel awkward. I want them to feel uncomfortable. That's the whole reason I do that bit of just standing holding the teddy bear with this Teddy Bear's Picnic music playing louder and louder and louder and louder until it cuts. And then I tell them it's basically because I do have 2 younger brothers. And they have 2 kids each, and they're both married. And I am the oldest of the 3, and I have no kids, and I've always wanted to be a dad. And it is a big issue for men that they have that instinct, that reproductive instinct to be a dad, to be, you know, nurturing to a child. And but yet within our society, men are, you know, unfortunately deemed to be, you know, tough and not allowed to show emotions that way towards, I mean, you know, you give the example that, you know, I couldn't walk past a, and it's happened to me before, where you'd be looking at a kid on the street, like a baby or a little kid, and you'd be, you know, just look at them and give a smile, and like, I would feel warm. Like I would think, I wish I had a kid. And that's what I'm thinking. But then you catch the eye of the parent and they're immediately looking at me, looking at their kid, and they just make an assumption that, pervert, what the fuck is this? Why is he staring at my kid? And immediately get on the defensive, which is fine. I understand that. But unfortunately, because of society, if that, if I was a woman doing that, they would clock your eye and they'd be like another smile. They'd smile back and they would be like, yeah, I know. Isn't it cute? The kid's cute. And oh, kids are cute. But whenever they see a guy doing that, there's many, many issues there, you know, within our society that, that people have been brainwashed basically into. And I do, I've got four nephews and niece, two nephews and two nieces, and I just adore them. And I really, yeah, I really, that was a lot of my therapy was to do with that as well too, of not having kids and being 42 and feeling like I'm kind of past it a little bit, you know, of have I missed the boat? Because I now know that if I have kids at this age, by the time they're in their 20s, I'm going to be in my 60s, you know, and I'm going to be an old dad. I'm going to be one of these really old dads if I ever do have kids, you know.
All right, mate.
Sorry.
I've got a baby.
Yeah, I know. Sorry. I'm sorry.
But no, I know exactly what you mean.
But you know what I mean?
My temptation as your friend is to go, hey, man, come on, that's totally fine. At the same time, I'm like, as an interviewer, I'm going, and where's this going? Where is this thought coming from? I totally get where you're coming from.
But
and it's scary about the levels of energy. That's the fear I have.
Yeah.
Is, am I going to have the energy to be running around with him when he's 10?
I think we're okay, though, in our profession that we are, you know, we're coming from a different point of view as far as life goes. I think we will be fine. You know, people like us in our job of being street performers, comedians, whatever. We're very young at heart anyway.
Absolutely.
And we always will be.
Absolutely.
And we don't have that retirement thing in our heads. You know, you just don't retire from what we do. You just keep doing it until you pop your clogs and that's it. It's as simple as that. You never stop doing what we do. But yeah, back to the show, that piece with the bear and that honesty was something that I, and there was a couple of other bits in the show that you saw this year, the Milk Show. Where I wanted to be a lot more gentler and a lot more honest with the audience and not just do weird, absurd non sequiturs and still like, that made no sense. I wanted something. I wanted a chink in the armor to show the audience and then move on to something else and have them sitting there going, Jesus Christ, sort of like took us down into like reality there. It's like, whoa, and then off.
How many shows have you made? Was Release the Baboons your first?
No, it was the second one. The first one I did was the Sticky Bivouac, it was called, and it was 2009.
I remember that, because I remember thinking that photo doesn't look like you.
No.
I think.
Oh, the one with the... What one's that?
I'm not quite sure. Or maybe you've got a particular promo photo.
Oh, is it the one with the duck?
I saw it and I kind of was like, oh, I kind of made assumptions about that. And then I've seen you since then and gone, that doesn't... For me, that didn't...
Oh, right, okay.
I don't think it kind of got the warmth.
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
It's a bit serious. It's a bit, like, statement-y.
Yeah, probably. But that was a fun show. I did enjoy... And that was 2009, which is weird. You were talking about earlier on about all these new absurd clown comedians and stuff. 2009 is the...
That's the year it all happened. That's the year the cloud went over and some people got hit by cosmic rays.
It was big time. Honest to God, it was weird. It was 2009. The first year I started, I was in a terrible venue. And it was the first year I was ever there. I went with C Venues and went into this like venue that was in the back arse of nowhere. I'd never been to Edinburgh before. But anyway, 2009 was the year. Me, Dr. Brown, Sam Simmons, and... possibly Boy with a Tape in His Face. I'm not too sure if Sam was there that year, but they were all there for the first time in 2009.
Did you all have a little clubhouse meetup?
No, I think we were unaware of each other, completely unaware of each other, which is beautiful because, like, obviously since then, Sam's become aware of me. So's Phil. Sam Wills, I don't know Sam that well at all, actually. But Sam Simmons and Phil Burgers, like, all three of us have shared similar over the years now, knowing each other, gone, like, Sam came up to me a couple of years ago and was like, ah, yeah, hey, you doing, like, fucking, you're eating cornflakes. It's pretty good, Sam Simmons. Yeah. You're eating cornflakes. And I was like, yeah. And he was like, fuck. I was gonna. He was gonna do that. He was gonna do a similar thing anyway. He was like, "Fuck, you beat me to it." And then he was doing a thing with bread. I had a big bread fight in the show last year, and he'd done a bread thing. And then, but then I was doing a full bread fight with like 10 loaves of bread in the audience, and it was just a full on full room, a big bread fight.
I remember that. Yeah.
And he found out about that, and he was like, "Fuck again, it was shit." But it's fun though. There's these lovely little connections with props and stuff that we've all used something similar, or
toy babies.
Yeah, all our heads kind of working in similar ways, and which I love. I mean, the first time I went to see Dr. Brown, he got me on stage with him as well too that year. Not knowing that I, you know, and not knowing me and not knowing what I did. But I loved it. It was just beautiful. And we had this lovely just connection, because it wasn't a verbal piece. It was all just visual. And it was just gore. I just had so much fun with him. And we spoke afterwards and I told him, and we've just been friends ever since. But he was using cornflakes in a show that year, as was I.
Yeah.
And I was like, as soon as I saw the cornflakes on the stage, I was like, shit, somebody else is using cornflakes. It's like going to see, it's like another a comedian, a verbal comedian, going to see another verbal comedian and hearing a fucking similar joke. Absolutely. And going, bastards, he's using the same gag. Or so yeah, because we use a lot of props, I just.
So something I know about Phil is that he did the Goliath course.
Yeah.
And I don't think Sam Simmons has done something equivalent. And you're a kind of circus background.
Yeah, I've never done Goliath.
Circus training anyway.
Yeah, I did a lot of clown workshops with really good lesser known clowns, but
which kind of people?
With Fraser Hooper.
Yes.
A guy called Tony Trafalgar, who is a Danish clown. The really lucky thing that I have in Belfast, for me anyway, developing what I do, the comedy that I do, is that I've got a great platform within the circus school, that the director, Will Chamberlain, who runs the circus school, is a clown. Mm-hmm. That was his thing. He doesn't do it anymore, but he is a clown, and he's got that kind of clown brain, clown heart. And he, over the years, like, I've been doing it for 16 years now, he's brought over various clowns to do workshops with us. And another guy was John Lee.
Yes, okay.
John Lee.
I don't think I've worked with John Lee, but I've heard of him.
John Lee was great. And another guy called Joe Nacapelle.
Okay.
Who's an American clown. And also Jonathan Taylor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know John.
Yeah. And he's done some workshops with us, and I've also performed at the Festival of Fools with him in Belfast as well too.
Okay.
And
he's fantastic.
He's amazing.
Jonathan Taylor's collector character.
Yeah.
He's just brilliant.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
Let me just put on record, we're all pretty sure that the Sony Bravia advert where they loads of bouncy
they ripped
balls
it off
the street, were just nicked off
all
him.
The bouncy balls down the street. Yeah, they completely nicked that off him. Yeah.
So
I've had a lot of experience doing clown workshops over the years, but not Goliath. I specifically kind of have been shying away from him because of the trend, the horrible sycophant trend that everyone sort of has to have Goliath on their CV now to have some kind of worth in their show, and it's just bullshit. There was a Goliath workshop, weirdly enough, you should say that, 2 weeks ago. He was over for a week.
Okay.
In Belfast, running a workshop for a week, and I had a lot of friends doing it, and I was tempted, but I didn't. But I went to chat. He did a chat one day, just a Q&A session, and I went and saw him. And I have to say, actually, that sort of made me consider a bit more. He seems like a nice enough chap.
There is something about clown workshops where is there an aspect of it whereby you are already a successful professional clown performer, and you need to kind of humble yourself to
absolutely
yeah, that's quite weird, isn't it? Because loads before I was a comic, and I find it hard. I did Phil's a few years ago, which was brilliant, and of all the clown workshops I've done, it was probably the one that made me hate myself the least.
Yeah, I know, there's very few clown workshops where they will focus on the positive things that you're doing. Very few of them will say, yeah, what you just did there was great. It's all about the negative. It's all about what you've did is wrong, and
really
stripping you down. But I think it's a lot to do with the ego thing as well, too, the kind of strip back your ego. Because if you think about it, everyone's there for a reason, because they think they're funny, or they think they've got that in them. So then, ergo, it's for the it's up to the tutor or the leader of the clown workshop to basically strip back that ego and the reason why you're there, to then build that back up again and have you question it more, because you're going, you are there for.
You're there so that you can be the one everyone looks at.
Yeah. You're there to show off. Whether you're still quiet in the workshop, you're there for a reason, to, because you know that you like to show off in front of people, and you think somewhere in the back of your head that you are funny. But the worst thing you can do, I think, is to not participate in a circus workshop. I believe there was a lot of gully. I didn't really push many, although it was a large workshop of about 30 odd people. So obviously he couldn't focus on everyone, but there was a lot of people just sitting there taking notes.
Yeah.
Which is bullshit. You know, you need to get involved. You need to get active and physical within a clown workshop, or you're just pointless, really. You know, to be honest, you're not going to learn anything. You're only going to learn it when you're up there stripped bare, literally bare. Oh, bearing your soul and your
I always
it's scary. It's scary as fuck. Like, but I mean, you've got
it. The problem I had with it was something that Angela De Castro said. At a clown workshop with her years ago.
Yeah,
she said about like clowns. You have to own it. You have to take responsibility for your terrible decision.
Mm.
And now that I'm some distance from clowning, I do wonder about my own perceived inability to do that. Is sort of to do with the person I was at school and not wanting to be a target for ridicule.
Yeah.
Like I really just, like I always, I think looking back, that's what tripped up my own clown kind of practice. I needed to be gobby. I needed to win. And, you know, it turned into the type of stand up that I do now, which I think is a bit more open hearted now than me trying to just be the funny guy desperately,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But I do think there's something about ego, and to be a good clown, I wonder if you have to be able to let go of the ego and fail in front of people.
Oh, absolutely.
Not just strangers, fail in front of people who know you. You've got to be prepared to eat shit see, I'm just another failure.
Yeah, yeah.
And I like in my heart, I tense up when I think about that. I'm like, no, I don't want them to know I'm a failure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What's your relationship to that?
I just go out to play, really. I mean, I go out to just play with an audience. I mean, and as long as it's a very simple philosophy, but as long as I'm having fun, because audiences smell the fear within any performer, but they, especially with comedians, they smell it immediately. As soon as you walk on stage, it's your body language, and which clown and workshops come in very, very handy for this, but it is your body language. I mean, what I like to do and tell, like a lot of comedians who are maybe starting out and stuff like that, is just to, if you're watching it, take your favorite comedian. If you're into verbal stand-up, watch your favorite comedian, somebody like even Stuart Lee, for example, and turn the sound down. Don't listen to his jokes. Watch what he's doing on stage. Watch how they're walking around on that stage and how they're moving on the stage. It's hugely important. That is just as important as what is coming out of their mouths. Because people focus on the jokes too much. You could be on a stage. I love being on a stage. And it's the whole doing nothing, literally doing nothing on a stage. And you can get laughs out of that. I used to do a piece. I do it from time to time where I just stand behind the microphone and act like I'd forgotten what I'm going to say, forgotten the joke. And I just stand there and hold it for as long as possible with just my mouth and using my eyes and my eyebrows to just communicate to the audience that it's almost on the tip of my tongue of what I'm about to say, but I'm not making any noise. It's just my mouth and my eyes and my eyebrows. And the audience have been absolutely cacking themselves laughing from this, you know. And the more you can hold that, and the more you can milk that, it's just fascinating that you can get. It's always fascinated me. The reason why I do what I do is that I want to find other ways of mining laughter from an audience, to mine and squeeze laughter out of them, but not with the obvious jokes that everyone else is doing. There's other ways to do it, you know, physically or with noises or with just, yeah, there's other ways of doing it.
So let's talk then about...
Same way with the music. It's like there's other way to entertain people with music, but you don't have to just like stand and strum a guitar like all the other folk singers or all the other, you know, but there's other ways of exploring comedy the way there is other ways of exploring music and evoking emotions from people through music, but via comedy, evoking laughter from people but there's other ways of doing it.
So what are the starting points then for something like that? Presumably before you go out there and pretend to have forgotten that you're, you know, or you play that game, play, not pretend, before you go out there and play that game, you've got to have the idea for that game.
Yeah.
So do you have, are you like keeping a notebook of ideas for bits or the cornflakes thing?
Yeah. I would write it down. I would take a note of it.
And can you then rehearse it? Can you rehearse the cornflakes not in front of an audience?
No, you need an audience. It's a two-way thing. I mean, I describe it like it's like sex. Either just, are you going to sit in the house and just wank, have a wank? And then imagine what it's like to have sex with someone and pretend to have... It's just like watching porn or having... You need to go and sleep with someone. You need to be physical with somebody else if you want to know what that's like. It's a two-way thing. Stand-up comedy is a two-way thing. You need the audience there. And sometimes you can go out, and if it's not working... Like, you need to charm the audience. It's like a first date when you're going and performing in front of an audience. It's a first date. You got to charm them and you got to win them over, and then you'll have a good night. Otherwise, literally like you're in bed together, and otherwise it's just literally you're on top while they lie there reading a book and you're just pathetically humping away at this person until it's over, and then you get off them and they're like, yeah, whatever, thanks very much. A lot of stand-up can be like that when you're watching it. People are just sitting there wishing the act would just get the fuck off them, get off the stage, get away from me, but they just sit through it. Whereas, you know yourself, whenever it's working, it's magic. It's magical. You walk on a stage, complete strangers, but you're immediately, everyone's on board, everyone's in it, everyone's on it. What I do, I want that. Obviously, I want that. But also, I like to play around with the room as well, too. I like to divide the audience up as well, too. I don't want everyone to be on board or to take a while to get on board. You know, I don't want to hand it to them on a plate. It's like, you know, I'm a huge fan of independent cinema and stuff as well, too. I don't want to go and watch a movie that, you know, where it's all just the plot and everything is just handed to me on a plate. I want to work shit out myself. I want to figure out where they're going, why they're doing that, you know. And I kind of see that in a lot of the comedy that I do and the comedy that I enjoy watching. I mean, I always go back to like my biggest, one of my big turning points, my like Elvis moment in comedy was whenever I first saw Vic Reeves, Big Night Out, 91, something like that, 91, 92. And I saw that one night and literally came into college the next day and went, did anybody see that last night? The fuck was that about? And it just literally blew my mind. That was my big Elvis moment of like, what?
The man with the stick.
Yeah.
And just the, that this is the show.
Yeah.
Everyone is shouting what's on the end of
the
stick.
I just that was my big, that was like my Elvis kind of moment of whenever I discovered punk, real punk comedy was like, fuck yeah, that was, it blew my mind. And then I started sort of going back to really discover like the roots of Vic Reeves's influences. And I mean, obviously having gone to art college as well too, I was very much always into Dada, stuff like that. I didn't know what it was at the time, but I eventually got into Dada art and stuff, and that anarchy art, you know, the art.
Dada, I think of like absurdist performance art.
It's everything. It's a huge, big umbrella of just anything that breaks the rules and just pushes the boundaries and just says fuck you to anything that comes along within the establishment, and you're just constantly kicking it down. And that's what I try to do with me, you know, because there's so many panel shows, there's so many, comedy has become so fucking mediocre at the minute on TV anyway, you know. I just where's the punk, where's the fucking punk rock in the, you know, because I see comedy in parallels with music and other mediums as well too, you know. And I want to see where the punk rock is.
Should the punk rock be on TV? Surely for the punk rock to exist, media, you know, mainstream TV should be a load of mediocre stuff.
Yeah, but there are outlets. I mean, I wouldn't have seen the Young Ones if it hadn't been for the, you know, sure. Auntie.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, good old Auntie on the BBC. Or was it Channel 4? Fuck, am I wrong?
BBC.
It was BBC, wasn't it? Yeah. I wouldn't have seen them.
Yeah.
Would not have seen them. I wouldn't have seen a lot of that stuff that was on TV back then. But obviously, producers back then were, you know, a different breed. And now there's a different... It's all to do with the producers and who and the programmers who's letting this stuff
it's
through.
It's about risk, isn't it? It's like no one can risk anything.
No, there's no risk left anymore. On TV, anyway, there's no risk. I mean, they let in the occasional these little internet things that they let people like Sam Simmons do. And they let Dr. Brown.
And even that just seems like such a jumping through hoops method.
Exactly.
Like, it's a way of abdicating risk.
Yeah.
We'll only do the stuff that gets the most... Yeah. Only the blap that gets the most hits will then get a pilot.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
out of all the pilots that get the most hits... Yeah. I mean, I'm probably quite wrong there. And I say blap in a generic way rather than single out a specific network.
Yeah.
But it does seem to me it's like... In the great shift from TV dying, to, you know, where TV tries... Let's try and recreate what's working on the internet.
Yeah.
But no, because the internet's doing that.
Yeah.
You know, and on I think... What do you think about this? Online, I think there is genuine risk stuff. If you look at something like Don't Hug Me, I'm Scared, have you seen that?
No.
You'd fucking love that.
Right, okay.
It's like five or six videos, and it's puppetry, and
right,
it's like
okay.
for kids, except it goes really dark and wrong, and is very
cool.
absurd.
I like it.
We'll watch some after this.
All right, okay.
I direct all right. everyone to look at Don't Hug Me, I'm Scared.
Okay.
I'm trying to get the makers of that on the show, but it's very
awesome.
Difficult. But, or those things which are like, just thinking of other stuff, like Rob Cantor's Shia LaBeouf song. On YouTube, you know, it's a massive contemporary dance piece with big props and big production values about being chased through the woods by Shia LaBeouf. Do you know what I mean?
I have heard of that.
I
yes,
feel like that's kind of really.
But why I want to see
stuff.
That on mainstream TV though as well.
Sure.
I think because I always go back to the fact that if you think about it, and it just blows my mind that the Goon Show, which is still to this day, you listen to the Goon Show, it is still fresh. It is still like nothing else that's out there and has ever been written since then. It is just the most insane, absurd, wonderful, magical, fucked up madness. And everybody, that was the biggest listening. They had the biggest listenership right across the UK back then in the 50s on the wireless. Everybody would sit round. Mm-hmm. You know, mother and father listening on the radio to the Goons, and now the Goon Show, you know, and it was the most fucking mental. You listen to it now, it is fucking mental, and it's better than anything that has come since and before or since. Like, it blows Python out of the water, it blows Vic Reeves out of the water, it blows the Mighty Boosh out of the water. It's fucking amazing. The Goons is still yet to be recognized as the ground zero of modern absurdist comedy, you know, within the medium of, you know, the modern media, radio, and then on the TV. But it's just mind-blowing. But yet, everybody back in the 50s was listening to this and lapping it up and getting it, more to the point. Getting the silliness, getting that madness, but everybody was loving it. And for some reason, from that point, and they had the biggest listenership right across. I mean, everybody... Millions of people were listening to this. And from then, you can just see this gradual decline in, I get the powers that be that run these, that run the radio and run the TV. Just not wanting so many people to hear this sort of, that sort of comedy for some bizarre reason. I don't know why. It just got smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller until there's just a tiny little sort of niche, little, the odd... You know, them. They might feed the masses the odd little absurdist, you know, minnow, and that's it. You know, there's no big fucking fat absurd trout anymore for everyone to get stuck into and fucking fill their bellies with it. You know, sorry.
I'm just going to enjoy that image for a second.
Sorry, thank you. Cheers.
If things were different and absurdist stuff was everywhere, would there be less attraction
want,
for
you? You wouldn't want
being,
it to be.
Because
no,
you're the
of course
outsider
not.
At the moment. You are one of a small band of rebels against the kind of mainstream standard fare.
Yeah, but it definitely needs to be accessible, and it's just not, unfortunately. There's not really... Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I have fought the system quite a bit over the years. I mean, I had a lot of big offers from big agencies over the years, and my punk morals got the better of me, and I just backed away from them. So I mean, I have had a chance to. I don't know where the freaking hell I would be right now if I had have. I'm glad I didn't, though. I don't have any regrets of not taking on those big offers and stuff like that. And
when you say offers, you don't need to make. I'm not asking you to be specific.
I'm not mentioning any names.
No, but sure. But what? Like, you say like a big eight. Like, what do you mean by a big offer? Like an offer of a TV show?
Representation of companies that would have led to panel show offers,
yeah,
probably live at the Apollo offers, because I've seen my contemporaries that were offered those, that had those offers on the table at the same time as me, they took them, and that's where they are now, and that's fine, and that suits them. It's absolutely fine. I it's great. And I'm really chuffed for them. I'm really proud to see them doing so well. But it just didn't suit me. It just didn't suit me, I guess. So I have no regrets from it. When I think about it too much, I do worry about like where the hell I may have gone with that, you know, what it might have done to my head a little bit, because it just isn't for me, you know.
It is interesting to if you're going to be a rebel and an outsider and a punk in your 40s, when you want to be traveling, especially if you do decide if you are able to have a kid,
yeah,
and you don't want to necessarily travel as much and be as much of a road warrior as you were.
Oh no, I'd love to. I'd love to. But I'm talking about in the concept of stand up comedy and stand up comedy on TV. I also have, luckily, the ability to go and do the street,
sure,
which is a whole other, you know, yourself. It's a whole other beast. And a whole other freedom there for you as well, too, you know. And I was pushing to try and get Melbourne for next year, the Melbourne Comedy Festival, to get in there to do my show in Melbourne. And but I've been offered the street festival in Melbourne to do the street show.
Right.
And I'm actually really relieved to be doing that a lot more, that I'm going to get to do the street over in Melbourne and get to do my stuff too.
Is it more free? Is it why you're relieved?
Yeah, because it's freer. It made me realize just how much I love doing the street more than stand-up comedy clubs. I fucking hate stand-up comedy clubs. There's way more pressure on everyone. So much pressure on the audience, pre-expectations on the audience, because they've bought a ticket or whatever. They're paid in to be there. They're sitting on their seats. The lights go down. They're on a stage. And there's this big white elephant in the room with comedy. And I'm going to just say it. It's theater. It's just theater. It's one person on a stage reciting rehearsed material. Whether there is a bit of improv chucked in there anyway, it's still rehearsed. Their whole character's rehearsed, because the person that they are on stage is not them. It's just not them. You meet a comedian off stage, it's not the same person. It's always disappointing when you meet them, you know, because they're a lot quieter. They're usually a lot quieter, a little bit more introverted, apart from Tom Stead. And yeah, he won't mind me saying
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Tom won't mind me saying that, because we go way back. Yeah, he's even larger when he's off stage.
So it's theatre.
It's theatre. It's just theatre. No, but nobody wants to admit it. It's one of those things. It's like nobody's like, it's not cool. Nobody wants to go, hey, do you want to go down to the theatre club? You know, like, to see the funny people in the little independent theatre club
doing the thing that they're pretending is improvised.
It's not. It was the same thing that happened with Eddie Izzard whenever people started to try and sue him and shit back then. But years and years ago, somebody went to see his show twice.
Yeah.
This famous case where...
I'd never heard of this.
Yeah.
It I was see like, what the territory is. Like.
Yeah, and they saw the show and they were like, it's just all rehearsed. It's not... So they were really disappointed to see an entire show that... And you were like, yeah, what the friggin' hell? What did you expect? Did you think this was all made up on the spot and it was all... No? So there was one disgruntled punter. I remember seeing this on a documentary about Eddie Izzard. And the punter was so pissed off that whenever they went to see the show for a second time that it was all just rehearsed and it was all just scripted. And they tried to get their money back or something. I don't know. They tried to sue. I don't know. Some madness anyway. But yeah, it's fascinating that people just kind of... it's like puppetry. Whenever you're watching especially when the puppeteer is visible and the puppet's in front of them, you just forget about the puppeteer. If it's done well, puppetry's done well, you'll ignore the puppeteer and you'll just focus on the puppet.
Yep.
And you'll... be that as an adult or a kid. I've seen adults, and I that's one of the things that I love about puppetry, is that you suspend your disbelief and focus on the puppet. It's the same with comedy. Everyone's kind of suspending. They know. Everybody knows.
Yeah.
Everybody knew there was like bearded hippies underneath the Muppets. There was bearded hippies under the Muppets. Everybody knew this, but you just forget that. You can forget. You don't need to because you're not showing it.
Yeah. But so it, when you see a stand-up comic, you'll probably be that everyone knows that there is either
everybody's
a
in
bearded
on it.
Hippie or a suit-wearing money guy.
Yeah.
You know, or whatever that yeah. that person's
or,
actual personality.
Or the comedian on stage will acknowledge that big white elephant in the room that, you know, like somebody who does pull apart the structure of stand-up, somebody like Tony Law. He does it beautifully, you know. For example, there's other comedians that do it as well, but Tony does it really well. He breaks down the structure of how comedy is put together, how jokes put together, how you walk on stage, and how banter, the whole banter thing that he did, you know, banter,
yeah,
and just having, you know, shit banter with the audience, but acknowledging that that's just what comedians do. That's the format, and that's what hundreds of them do. Hundreds of them, thousands of the bastards every night of the you know, the week in comedy clubs right across the globe will do that same format, and people will just buy into it happily, like a comfortable meal that they go to, like meat and two veg. Yep, I like my Sunday roast, that's all I want. I know what's in it, it's no surprises, there's no spices, there's nothing weird, that's all I want. But then that's not what everybody wants. Simple as that. Everybody wants
and your angle is that they don't know that they want it, so it needs there needs to be more accessible.
Yeah, they don't. They haven't tried it. Yeah, some people, whenever they get a taste of it, they're like, oh, fucking hell, this is a bit different, but I like it. This is still, yeah, and it sparks bits of their brains off. Like, whenever the first time I saw Vic Reeves, it just knocked. And whenever I watch Python and Spike Milligan and stuff like that, there's something in your brain. It does something. It makes your brain go wobbly. Something weird, like zingy. It makes your brain go a bit zingy because it's all non sequiturs, especially like early Steve Martin stuff as well. First time I heard and watched like really early Steve Martin, whenever he was at his height of his
wild
game.
And crazy guy.
Yeah. You watch that stuff and it is just, you don't know what's coming next. And he explains it really well in his book, The Born Standing Up.
Yeah.
And he explains it really well. It's just like he wanted to leave. And that's kind of where I was coming from as well. That's what I wanted to do in my comedy as well, was to leave the audience laughing at a piece that you did three bits back and you're already three bits forward. So they're constantly trying to keep up with you, constantly trying to, rather than just leading them along going, and then this happened, and then, you know, pull back and reveal, and then move it on to the next joke. No, you're racing ahead, and they're trying to keep up with you the whole time, throughout the whole show. And then you'd stop occasionally, and then they'll eventually catch up, and then you'll be off on another tangent, you know, with all these non sequiturs in it. That kind of comedy appeals to me, and that's what I always try to put on stage.
We were talking about the difference between the theatre of stand-up and the street in the context of Melbourne. So there's less pressure on the... There's less expectation.
Yeah, there's less pressure on everyone. You have to keep... It's up to you as well, though. There's less pressure on the audience. There's no less pressure on you. There's probably more pressure on you because... Well, a little bit more pressure because you have to keep the audience. You got to keep... Because they can walk away. They can walk away at any time they want, unless they're sort of, you know, sitting down the front row. But they can. They can bugger off. You know, the world is right there. There's no walls or anything. You're outside. They can piss off whenever they want. So you have to have a real charm to be a street performer. You got to have a proper, real something honest and charming to keep an audience there and an honesty that they're going to want to stay and watch you, especially the stuff that I do. Because I'm not doing like big juggling tricks. I'm not on a giraffe unicycle. I'm not, you know, juggling fire. I'm not doing any of that. I'm literally doing fuck all on the street. I'm dicking around like a big man child. And that came from one of my biggest influences would have been Dr. Palfi.
Yeah.
Whenever I saw him perform, I was just amazed that he had all these props, but he did nothing with them. He very rarely went over to them. It would be general banter. It would just be general kind of talking bull, just playing around, playing about him. The other clown I love, Rumpel. Yeah, I saw him a couple of years ago in the Festival of Fools in Belfast. Again, two suitcases full of props, just madness, just like, yeah, I loved it. I just loved the chaos of it, of him just not seeming and not actually knowing what the hell he was doing, you know. But yet he did.
I totally agree. Oh, he's a nutcase.
Yeah.
And really authentic.
Yeah. I do. I love that genuine madness. Again, it's back to the madness again, of genuinely somebody opening up that. That's what a good clown does. A good clown does open up fully to an audience. Doesn't put on a persona. It's not theatre. The material is rehearsed where it's there. You've got the props and stuff, but you can go off on tangents, so many tangents as well too, and it's easier to do on the street as well. But yeah, Palfy and Rumpel and Herbie Treehead would be another one as well too. He's just his madness on the street, his manicness. But it's play. It's play. They're big kids. They're children. It's not dangerous.
Yeah.
It's dangerous in the fact that as other adults watching it, they'll be like, oh, this guy's mental. They'll make that judgment and go, this guy's fucking mental. The kids, though, love it because they get it. Kids get it. And that's a lot to do with my show. I mean, I just want adults to be kids again.
Making stuff in front of children that you can then take on to do in front of adults.
Yeah.
There's one of the other things, and we must wrap up soon. I've got two final questions. One is about your manner on stage, which in all of your reviews points out, like all of your reviews go, this is nuts. He gets the audience involved, but don't stay away. It's great. He's really nice. Do you know what I mean? So many of your reviews that have a common theme of everyone's on stage buttering an ironing board. Everyone's joining in, but don't stay away. He's a really good, he's really warm. He's really nice. He's really, someone said he's really amenable. I don't know if that was right.
Yeah, probably. Sounds about right. Yeah.
But maybe that comes from making the stuff for kids or being used to perform.
I think so. I mean, I do. I teach kids all the time. You know, I teach 2 to 7 year olds in circus school and I love it. They're one of the biggest influences and inspirations for me. You know, the material that they come off with that I plagiarize. just the stuff that they say is just where their heads are at. I look at them and I envy them so much. I'm like, I wish I could be. I try to do that on stage, try to come down to that level, go back to that level. Not even come down to it, just go back, because we were all kids. And that's the problem. We've forgotten that. We've forgotten that we are that. That's part of our development as humans is, you know, we close that door and we shouldn't fucking close that door, you know. Keep that door open of being innocent and playful.
Are you getting out of your career what you wanted to?
Yeah, very much so, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yep. It's what I always... I'm very happy with where I am, actually, with it. I didn't want to go down that route of what a lot of other stand-up comedians that started out around me did. I mean, I'm envious in the way that the likes of Sam Simmons and Dr. Brown have a lot more profile, but that's through their own fucking hard work, and I respect them so much for that. Maybe not, I haven't been as lucky as them, but I'm also maybe not as motivated as them in that they probably have a better drive, and I respect them for that as well too a lot. Like I said, I've shied away from a lot of big opportunities in the past that I
do you think there's just part of that luck is that they got spotted first. It's maybe quite difficult for you to get an award for blowing everyone's minds when they kind of became visible first.
Yeah, true.
I mean, that's a fucker, right? Like, it's nothing to do with them,
as
individuals, but one of those things that happens in stand-up is people go, wow, this guy's doing something we've never seen before. And you're like, really? Have you never seen that before?
Yeah.
Because people have been doing that for a long time.
Yeah.
And you kind of...
But I feel the same way as well, too. Like, Sam Wills, everybody losing their shit over Sam, and I went to see him, and he's great. He's a great clown, but I'd seen a lot of that clown and technique and style before. Yeah. But he's presenting it in a new way, which
he's
is the way it's
very
done.
Motivated, very
and he's
driven.
Extremely friggin' driven and extremely motivated with but I love how he presents it in a modern he repackaged it so well for a modern audience, you know. Even just his look is just gorgeous, you know. It's so well not manufactured, but his marketing head. Mm-hmm. Clearly he is very motivated and he has a very good marketing head, and how his image as well is just fucking brilliant, you know. You can't fault the guy at all, and he is a superb clown, fucking brilliant clown, you know. And
so I feel that you, when I see your shows at Edinburgh, I feel you're on an upward trajectory of kind of more and more people are going, fucking hell, you've got to see Paul Curry,
right?
Do you
really
recognize that? Yeah,
no,
I think so.
I don't recognize that at all. No, because I don't have anyone. See, I don't have anyone around me to tell me that shit.
Yeah, right.
I'm completely unaware of all this. In Edinburgh this year, it was just me. I don't have any manager. I don't have any PR team. I don't have anyone. It's just me. I design my own flyers, get them printed up myself, pay for all that, and then I flyer myself. I don't have a flyering team. The only people would be the door staff working for Bob Slayer, who I would occasionally ask how many tickets have been sold that day. But that is it. I have no concept of any kind of, if there is a buzz at all, or any kind of what. But just the fact, though, I guess the fact that people are coming to see the show, there was like really good numbers this year, but I kind of put that down in my head. I put that down to just going out and flaring for like 3 hours every day, which is what I did. And you know, you put in the work, people are going to, if you can charm them enough, obviously on the street. And I love talking to people on the street anyway. So when I'm flaring, that really helps, you know, the people are like, yeah, we'll give this guy a go. And it's only £5 in, so it doesn't cost much either. So you've got that going for you as well. I don't know. I have no idea. But I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying being with Bob Slayer in the Pay What You Want Fringe. It feels honest. It feels real. Having been with the Pleasants and stuff in the past and see venues and things, this feels a lot more DIY punk and a bit more real, I guess. It feels like the real fringe. It feels like you're part of the real fringe rather than just a big, big corporate monster, you know, with all these people making so much money off all these hardworking acts, you know, that are going out there and fucking putting themselves in front of bang audiences every night, you know. And then these producers and directors and venue owners are just walking away with a huge, huge profit from Edinburgh. It's just kind of sickening. Sickening to the point where I'm considering just like packing it all in quite soon, actually, and going off and following another dream of mine, which is to open up a cafe.
Is that right?
Really? Yeah.
Really?
Really, seriously? Considering it? Yeah, I've been considering this for a long time. Well, it would be a venue as well. I would run comedy in it too. But I've always wanted to open up a cafe, kind of hub, gallery, cafe, eatery, venue, you know. So I don't know. I might do that at some point. So I'm certainly not making a shitload of money from comedy that justifies me sticking at it, really, to be honest. You know, my main bread and butter is the circus. Teaching in the circus school in Belfast, you know, and I get a lot of satisfaction from that. We teach outreach workshops with like special needs groups at the local college, kids with autism as well too, kids and adults who suffer autism. We do a lot of work with them, and it's way more satisfactory, you know, than, and it doesn't necessarily pay well, but it's just, yeah, it's a lot more satisfactory than going out and getting judged by, you know, 100 people in a sweaty comedy club. You know, that can be fun to a certain degree, but it, life satisfaction, I don't know, you know, kind of like, I just like helping people, you know, and comedy audiences sometimes don't feel like they deserve it.
Well, to wrap up, you are every year, like, don't quit now. Don't quit now, man. Every year, I notice you have more and more of a presence. It's just that thing of, like, I get, you know, I've been doing stand-up for 11 or 12 years.
Yeah.
And I just felt this year, like, oh, something's changing. More people are coming.
Mm.
Oh, thank fuck. Because I've had those thoughts in the past of just going, well...
You felt this with your own stuff?
Fuck yes.
Yeah.
Like, you think, look, I've given this as hard a go as I possibly can.
Yeah.
There was a period about 2 years ago when I just went, do you know what? There's more to life.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
that's... Certainly gone up and down through those moments. Yeah. And this year, I feel like I've turned the corner and gone, oh, hang on, I'm so much happier.
Mm.
I feel like there were more people in the crowd who were there specifically to see me this year.
Yeah.
You know, and the stuff you're doing is so great. It's just...
Oh, thank you.
I feel like you're in a kind of Seymour Mace position. You need to get an award to remind you how much people love it.
No, I don't.
No, I don't mean for your personal... I mean, like... Your fans, and I count myself among that group, love you to get just another little bit of recognition and just go, oh, by the way, Paul fucking Curry.
Yeah.
So that the rest of everybody could get on board and we could all go, yeah, well, we, you know.
Oh, that's really sweet of you. Thank you. That's nice. yeah, I feel like I've probably got one more album in me. I think I've got one more show in me. I'll see how it goes next year. I do have a lot of new stuff that is a very different energy again than the last show, but we'll see how it goes. But I'll do one more show next year. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, absolutely. And then we'll see after that. The cafe's calling me, man. I really love the idea of running a cafe. I don't know why. Anyway, that'll probably all change next year though, when I win the award.
Thanks, man.
So thank you. That was Paul. Thanks to Paul for coming on. Don't be depressed, Paul. Don't give up. I mean, don't be depressed. That's ridiculous. Did you see that meme that was going around on Facebook recently? And it said, this is a lovely walk in the woods. It showed a picture of a lovely walk in the woods and it said, this is an antidepressant. And then it showed a picture of some antidepressants and it said, these are shit. And it's like, yeah, good sciencing, mate. Well done. Nonetheless, I don't mean don't be depressed. I mean, don't be. But I hope and am confident that Paul will continue down the road to sorting out his own mental health. He did also point out to me before the recording that he'd only had 2 hours sleep. So we will imbue him with slightly more positivity than at the very end of that episode might suggest. He's a wonderful performer, a really lovely man, and I heartily recommend you you check his stuff out. But for God's sake, Paul, don't pack it in and make a cafe. I mean, cafes are great, but there's only one Paul Curry. Come on. So that's all for now. Thank you very much to Matt Hoss for logging this episode. Thank you to Emily Crosby for her seemingly eternal work administrating on my behalf. And thanks to Saskatron for that as well. And thank you to Daryl Smith, who is the new editor of this show and is doing really well. Daryl and I are embarking on a venture to put these shows on YouTube. Embarking on a venture. Here's how I embarked on the venture. Daryl, can you put these shows on YouTube? All right, mate. He hasn't fucking done it yet, though, has he? That's because I've been fanning around with the image. So hopefully we're going to be able to make this show more discoverable on YouTube as well. Sadly, not with a full, nicely edited suite of a three-camera setup of each episode. So just a static image and the audio. That'll do for now. But many thanks to Daryl, and I'm thanking him on behalf of all of you listeners as well. So, I mean, why don't we have... You remember the Bugle had Fuck You Chris. Why don't we just have Thanks Daryl? Why don't we have hashtag Thanks Daryl? One R in Daryl on this particular occasion. So you can tweet me at ComComPod, email me info@comedianscomedian.com. If you're a stand-up comedian with 3+ hours of material under your belt, as in you've performed 3 different hours of material, not just ideas you had, you can email me with the secret code that you would like to be introduced to my beautiful daughter, and that way I know you're not just asking to be on the show, but you're asking to be on the show because you love the show. That's how that's done. And if you're a listener, or if you're anyone, and you would like to communicate something to me about your feelings about the show, remember, if you add PS I'm a cool guy, that basically lets me off the hook and lets me reply to you with one word, or I mean, I normally do at least a sentence, and it just helps me get on with my life, more of which I will tell you about in the chatty bit coming up now. But for now, that concludes the podcast. Thanks for listening. ComediansComedian.com/tour for all of the dates. Okie dokie. Well, where to start? I tell you why I can relate to Paul's 2 hours of sleep. It's because I have not had much more than that myself. The Boutros has been kicking off. We have we're staying away this weekend while I do some gigs, and we've done the military effort that is involved in, I should say, my partner has done most of the military effort. I'm arriving at the gig earlier and then coming back while she's travelling 100 miles with a tiny screaming baby in a car and loading the car and all the shit that comes with a baby. Oh my god, we're actually now, I'm in a lovely living room and we have set up his little high chair, which is the IKEA model, can't remember what it's called, but it's the dead cheap, incredibly good one that everyone swears by. Got a little high chair as we wean the little ween. And it's currently sitting inside, this is a little life hack for you, other parents of new children. It's sitting inside one of those huge, I mean, God knows what, like a 25 litre garden rubbish bag, but like it's one that sounds like this. Like that. So not like a bin bag, but like a really hardy thing for chucking branches and twigs in and stuff to take them to the tip. That job hasn't happened. But instead I have repurposed my brand new garden rubbish bag to have the high chair sitting inside it so that I can feed him, because the kitchen in this place is far too small to put a baby in, and all the stuff isn't here, and the room was too cold and he kept waking up. And there is nothing worse than waking up in the middle of the night worrying that your baby is cold. Like, I mean, there's many things worse than that, but there is something weird and primal about going, I have failed to adequately heat my baby. I think the radiator's broken, or if I turn it on then it's going to start making that ticking noise as the metal rubs against the metal as it warms up. You think that's going to wake him up as well? So he's just got to be a bit cold, and he's fine. He made it through the night. But now we're all frazzled, and it's that sort of family frazzle this really hard where you all love each other so much, but you're like, I'm so frazzled and I feel so guilty and I've made my baby cold. I think I'm reminded not for the first time about Tom Gleason's routine. Brilliant American, Australian stand-up, you'll remember from an early ep of this show. Tom Gleason had a wonderful routine about taking your baby to get injections, and all you really want to do is when they pull the needle out is just pick up the baby and kick them and run screaming down the street. Oh, God. Oh, it's a bit of a family frazzle, this one, just now. We're doing great. This is the point, you know. How am I? I'm great, thanks. How are you? Thanks. A couple of you emailed me about that, about trying to get into the habit of answering the question, how are you, with, yeah, really good, thanks. And you? Which is a slightly better way to live your life than going, well, here are all my worries. Why don't we compete in some pointless exercise? So, look, ultimately, I'm well. My partner is well. My baby is well. We're all well. It's all fine. But it's just like lying in bed going, oh, I got like a casting for a thing. I never do castings. And, I did loads. And then I've been lucky enough to be able to turn down the ones I didn't want to do. And now I've got one coming up that I do want to do. And I've had about 3 hours sleep. And there's that. And then I've got to do a gig later on that's quite an important, don't screw this up sort of a gig. Oh, so it is just, you're lying in bed and you're thinking to yourself, what of the things from the following day can I remove? What can reasonably remove? I suppose I could just quit my job. I could bail on this casting. I could just not turn up for the gig. I could just grab my family one under each arm and just run somewhere warm and sleepy. Oh my goodness me. I've been really enjoying the books of Julia Donaldson recently. This is a children's author. You've got to get into this shit when you're a dad. You'll know her from The Gruffalo. So, you know, I'm pretty late to the party here because we've all heard of The Gruffalo. But she's got this lovely little book called Sharing a Shell. If you saw, which show was it? If you saw An Hour, then you'll know that I have a real fondness for crabs for some reason. And I just love them. I just like crabs. I go rock pooling. I try and find a crab. It's just a thing I do. And she's got this little book called Sharing a Shell, and it's about a crab and a bristle worm and an anemone all sharing a shell. And I was reading it to the boy this morning and I started tearing up, and I can't pretend it was completely through lack of sleep. Here's a thing. Does anyone get this? I'm just looking at the ones on the floor here. Oi Frog. Oi Frog is an excellent book, but it doesn't make me cry. King Baby literally makes me cry. If you've not read King Baby by Kate Beaton, B-E-A-T-O-N, get hold of a copy of that. Zagazoo by Quentin Blake literally makes me cry. The simplicity of the narrative in most children's books, when they go, here is a thing that's been set up, and here is a thing. It's like the most reduced kind of reduced idea of narrative, like, here is a person that wants a thing. There's an obstacle in the way, and now it's resolved. And then you go, yes, that's lovely. And yet, I don't mean to suggest these are easy to write, because they're just such a distillation of story. They absolutely make the hairs stand up on the back of my neck, and they make the tears flow from my eyes, because there's something, you know, that narrative resolution of what, like, you know, in comedy terms, like a really excellent callback at the end of a show. Like there is, like there bloody is at the end of Compared to What, which if you've seen it, you know that last reveal, ha ha ha, yes, I am a clever boy. But, you know, when something happens like that in such short form, when someone kind of tells a story with 10 lines and you go, yes, but no, but yes, ah, I literally find myself reading to my baby son, and he doesn't even, you know, it's good to read to babies, but it's not like he can understand any of it. He just wants to eat the book. It's fine. That's his thing. Some delicious literature. That's what he's into. And yet I'm reading it to him, choking up at the end of one of these stories. The amount of times I've got to like the last page of Zagazoo where you realize what's actually going on, and you go, oh no, by then you've read this book, it's phenomenal. You realise what's happening, and then the last page you go, oh, of course, that's the only way it could end. Literally thinking of it now, I'm going, oh, that's so beautiful, man. Anyway, these are the deluded ramblings of someone who's had not enough sleep, and yet also, they're my real thoughts and opinions. So what was I talking about earlier on about the way, you know, your perception of the world is the world, as far as you're concerned, isn't it? If you're a depressed person and you think, God, everything's awful, then you feel like everything is awful and only you can see the truth of it. And then you get help and cheer up or have a better moment and you think, no, actually everything is like this. What an insane piece of human fate that we are all designed to be just a lens. And we are a human lens and we look at the world. And whatever we see, we go, oh, it is like this. And if our lens is in a good mood, we go, oh, it is, what a great world it is. And if our lens is in a shit mood, this is the worst analogy ever. Yeah, it's like a lens, but in a shit mood. Do you see what I mean? Do you see what I'm struggling to articulate? What a tragedy and what a beautiful thing at once. Ah, the nusness of life. There it is. Isn't life amazing?